Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Context is everything. So when Caterpillar announced this morning that profits had fallen 53%, all it took was three little words to make everything all right again. Better than expected. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constant Contact, dedicated to helping small businesses and nonprofits build strong customer relationships with email marketing and online surveys. ConstantContact.com. And by the Batten Institute, advancing knowledge about entrepreneurship and innovation at the University of Virginia's Darden School of Business. www.batteninstitute.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is great to have you here on this Tuesday. It is the 20th of October today, and the corporate hit parade reads a little something like this. Caterpillar, Pfizer, Wells Fargo, and DuPont, just a few of the companies that have reported better-than-expected profits so far this quarter. There are more to come, or so the folks who track these kinds of things tell us. So good news on the corporate health front means a recovering economy, right? Maybe. Marketplace's Elise Roth reports.
Don't get all excited yet about the economy getting better. These companies may be more efficient than they were before the recession, but most of them aren't actually selling more of the stuff they make or the services they offer. It's just that all the layoffs and other cost-cutting they've been doing for the last year are finally showing results. Gary Thayer is a strategist at Wells Fargo Advisors, and he says this is just what usually happens in a recession.
Companies have a lot of excesses going into the downturn, and they need to clean up those problems before we can escape the recession and get back to growth.
And he says it looks like companies are ready to start growing again, and so is the economy. Art Hogan is a market analyst at the investment bank Jefferies & Company, and he thinks the signs of recovery are real.
What these earnings can tell us is, we've sort of moved off of the bottom in this cycle, and we're on the road to repair here.
But it's not just that companies have right-sized themselves, as the analysts like to say. Gary Thayer from Wells Fargo says the weak dollar is helping a lot.
As the dollar goes down, that makes American products a little more attractively priced to foreign buyers. But also, a lot of American companies are international. And so any monies that they earn overseas, the value of those earnings tend to be higher if those countries' currencies have gone up in value.
American companies can't count on the dollar being weak forever, and most of them have already cut back as much as they can. So if the economy is really going to grow, companies need to start finding ways to make money, not just save it. In New York, I'm Elisa Roth for Marketplace.
The holiday shopping season is getting going, anemic though it may turn out to be. There is a lot of buzz about electronic book readers out there. Amazon just upgraded its Kindle recently. Today, Barnes & Noble joined the e-reader crowd with the Nook. What does it have that the Kindle and the others don't? Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman turns that page.
The Nook's wireless, so you can buy and download books fast, just like the Kindle. Plus, it has a split screen, color for photos and touchscreen commands, black and white for text. The Kindle, just black and white. The Nook's got another feature, too, for all those consumers who still love to own and share books. Sarah Rotman Epps follows the e-reader market at Forrester Research.
In the physical world, you can lend a book to a friend, and you can't read that book while your friend has it. That's something similar that they'll be setting up with the ability to lend your friend an ebook and not have access to it, but be able to share the pleasure of reading that book.
The idea that a consumer can lend a book to someone else is a piece of consumer behavior that nobody else has really picked up on yet.
That's Carl Howe, a consumer technology analyst with the Yankee Group. He says the social aspect of the Nook, plus Barnes & Noble's huge online catalog, will help it compete with Amazon. But neither may be enough to get consumers to embrace the technology en masse. I caught up with Catherine Rigsby at a bookstore in Portland, Oregon. She just plunked down $200. She is considering an e-reader.
I'm enticed by it's easier to carry one little reader than 10 books like we have right here. But again, I like the physical, tactile sensation of reading and holding that book.
Rigsby says she's also put off by the price. The Kindle and Nook are at the low end, $259, but analysts say e-readers probably need to get under $200 to really take off. In Portland, I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Wall Street wanted nothing to do with those better-than-expected profit reports today. We will have the details when we do the numbers. As states try to figure out how to balance their budgets in the face of declining tax revenues, they are making cuts almost everywhere. Schools and infrastructure spending, and especially social services. Not all of those cost savings are going to stick, though. Here in California, a federal judge has barred the state from cutting money from an in-home care program for the elderly and disabled. And Marketplace's Jeff Taylor explains that other states may well see their proposed budget cuts rolled back by the courts as well.
Social activists have been taking states to court over budget cuts. Melinda Byrd is senior counsel with Disability Rights California, which sued the state to block cuts in home health care.
We're seeing in California and other states this dynamic of balancing the budget on the backs of the poor and the disenfranchised.
Byrd says the people she represents are particularly vulnerable.
3/4 of the people on this program are over age 60. They tend not to be outspoken, and it's easy to cut their benefits, but it also violates federal law.
The state plans to appeal the ruling. If this and other court decisions stand, where does that leave California?
It will leave the budget out of balance.
Stephen Levy is director of the Center for Continuing Study of the California Economy. He doesn't foresee a mad scramble by legislators to come up with alternate cuts.
I doubt that they'll come back in November or December and make any budget adjustments.
But Levy expects California's governor will bring out the axe early next year.
It could well mean that additional cuts will be made in January or February.
Budget cuts have also been challenged in other parts of the country. Last month, a judge in Washington state ordered that disrupted services for the elderly and disabled be restored. If states can't save money on these programs, they may need to make even more severe cuts in next year's budgets, and that will likely lead to more lawsuits. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Taylor for Marketplace.
Despite its name, the Commodity Futures Trading Commission does much more than keep an eye on trades in pork belly futures and winter wheat prices. The CFTC is the federal agency that regulates trading in derivatives, things like credit default swaps that you'll recognize from the days of the AIG bailout. Those swaps helped drag the whole financial system to the brink of collapse last year, so there's been a lot of talk lately about coming up with new regulations for the derivatives market, and so the CFTC is in the financial news all the time. In the mid and late 1990s, though, most people didn't even know the CFTC existed. They probably didn't know about the warnings its chairman was giving about the dangers of derivatives trading. And they almost certainly didn't know that she was completely ignored. Tonight, Frontline on PBS offers its documentary about that story, The Warning. Frontline's Michael Kirk reports.
In 1996, the U.S. economy was on a roll. The stock market was midway through its greatest run in history. And in August, President Bill Clinton named a new head of the CFTC, Brooksley Bourne. Her first priority? To look into the booming new market in over-the-counter derivatives.
My staff began to say how big this was and how little information they had about it.
That year, the market in over-the-counter derivatives was worth roughly $20 trillion and growing at about 20% annually. But it wasn't the market's size or the speed of its growth that worried Bourne.
There was no transparency. There was no record-keeping requirement imposed on participants in the market. We had no information.
Bourne believed the lack of transparency left the market open to fraud. Joe Nocera is a reporter with the New York Times. He says fraud came up during Bourne's first meeting with the chairman of the Federal Reserve, Alan Greenspan.
He said something to the effect of, well, Brooksley, we're never going to agree on fraud. You probably think there should be rules against it. She said, well, yes, I do. He said, you know, I think the market will figure it out. And take care of the fraudsters.
Instead of taking the hint, Bourne began investigating. She immediately ran up against opposition from the president's working group on financial markets. She even got an angry call from Larry Summers, the deputy treasury secretary.
They were totally opposed to it. That puzzled me. You know, what was it that was in this market that had to be hidden? So it made me very suspicious and troubled.
Summers, his boss at the Treasury, Robert Rubin, and Alan Greenspan were big believers in letting the markets look after themselves. Mark Brickell is a former derivatives banker at J.P. Morgan Chase and an industry lobbyist. He says Greenspan wanted to regulate over-the-counter derivatives as little as possible.
He had said that he perceived derivatives to be one of the greatest innovations in recent financial history, that the contracts, because they helped businesses and banks and governments manage the risks to which they were already exposed more efficiently than they could have done before, were doing something that was useful for the financial system.
Where Greenspan saw benefits, Bourne saw risks. She prepared a document that laid out her concerns. The president's working group discussed it at an emergency meeting in May 1998.
I happened to be sitting behind Brooksley and behind Greenspan.
Michael Greenberger was one of Bourne's aides at the time.
Greenspan turns to her. She turns to him. His face is red, and he's clearly quite upset. He was very adamant that this was a serious, serious mistake, that it caused untold damages to the financial services market, and that she should stop and not do this.
Undeterred, Brooksley Bourne published her list of concerns. The members of the working group struck back. They insisted Congress shut Bourne down. Four congressional committees called on her to testify, but they weren't persuaded. Instead, they stripped the CFTC of its powers to regulate the markets. Bourne quit. 10 years later, she watched appalled as the market collapsed.
It was my worst nightmare coming true. The toxic assets of many of our biggest banks are over-the-counter derivatives and caused the economic downturn that made us lose our savings, lose our jobs, lose our homes. And it was very frightening.
Despite the financial crisis, the market in over-the-counter derivatives is now more than $450 trillion in size. The House Financial Services Committee approved new rules for the market last week, but many people say the rules aren't enough to protect the economy. In Boston, I'm Michael Kirk for Marketplace.
Frontline's story of Brooksley Bourne's fight against Washington's economic establishment, The Warning, it's called, airs tonight on PBS. And now, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials gave back 0.5% today, 50 points, closed to 10,041. The NASDAQ also reversed 0.5%, 12 points, finished at 2,163. The S&P 500 forfeited 0.2%, that is 6 points, closed at 1,091. Poor prospects for the housing market hurt home builders. Lennar got nailed on fears that the economy is going to stay weak. Its shares fell more than 2.75%. Toll Brothers lost 1%, ditto for KB Home. As we mentioned earlier, earnings results steered some stocks to higher ground. Caterpillar shares made their best showing in a year. They dug up an extra 3% today. Apple continued to shine after yesterday's terrific earnings report. Its shares were up nearly 4.75% today. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 3.34%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term goals. 1-888-VANGUARD. And by Monsanto, committed to sustainable agriculture, creating hybrid and biotech seeds designed to increase crop yields and conserve natural resources. ProduceMoreConserveMore.com. Now you can take Marketplace with you wherever you go. Tap marketplace.org into your mobile phone for the latest business news, decoders that explain financial terms, and updates on the economic crisis.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. The Federal Reserve publishes its latest Beige Book summary of current economic conditions. A news conference at the National Press Club addresses the state of the world's vaccines. And the H1N1 flu is the topic of a Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee hearing. I'm Michelle Philippi.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter.
One of the great things about listener emails is that they really give you a sense of what resonates, which stories strike a nerve. We ran a story last week about being hit up for a dollar donation to one cause or another in the checkout line. Most of you gave that practice a big thumbs down. Marlene Atia of Rockville, Maryland, feels just the opposite, though. She says it helps her avoid those weekly petitions for more.
The organization cannot trace your gift.
A note about a story we ran a couple of weeks ago. We were telling you about urban farming in Detroit and said there are no grocery stores in the city. Our listeners there beg to differ. They say although there are no major chains, there are still plenty of great places to buy food. I talked to designer Nanette Lepore a couple of weeks ago about Mayor Michael Bloomberg's plans to rezone New York City's garment district and open it up for restaurants and hotels. Fashion industry blogger Brandon Graham of Brooklyn says people ought to vote with their wallets.
When the consumer buys from a designer that keeps their supplier and dollar in the U.S. or New York City, that is sending a powerful vote in what will happen to the district.
We had the RZA on the show last week. He's the founder of the hip-hop group Wu-Tang Clan. We didn't talk so much about his music, even though a lot of hip-hop is about money and the good life. Mostly, we explored his thoughts on how to live a good life. A lot of people were apparently surprised to hear the RZA on our show, among them Ken Reed, who works at the United States Naval Hospital in Yokosuka, Japan.
Pieces like this are definitely needed to make people understand that money isn't the tool to happiness, the mind is.
Finally, shock advertising, and a story we ran last week highlighting New York City's latest public health campaign. The city's trying to cut back on the consumption of sugary drinks, so it's put up posters showing soda being poured into a glass and then turning into globs of veiny, disgusting fat. Julie Feldman is a dietitian from Farmington Hills, Michigan.
These ads may convince some people to give up their favorite sweetened beverages, but that doesn't mean they will make healthier food choices or balance their caloric intake with adequate physical activity.
If you're shocked by something you hear on the broadcast, and even if you're not, write to us. It's marketplace.org. Click on the link that says contact. College Music Journal launches its annual music marathon today in New York City. CMJ is pretty much required reading for fans of independent music. And no independent label has really done more to bring a lot of bands from obscurity to the top of the college charts than Merge Records. Merge emerged 20 years ago in North Carolina, a joint venture of two punk rockers at the time, Laura Balance and Mac McCon. Over the past two decades, they have signed a whole catalog's worth of what eventually became indie staples.
'Cause it's all right Friday night to Sunday. It feels all right, keeps your mind on the page.
Time stands still, all I can feel is the time standing still as you put down the keys.
That was, in order, Spoon, The Magnetic Fields, and Arcade Fire, and there are way too many others to name. Laura Balance and Mac McCon are out with another collaboration, a book about Merge, called Our Noise. It's good to have you both with us.
Hi.
Thank you.
How did you guys go about finding the bands to put on the Merge label?
I mean, when we started, the bands were already kind of there for us, making music already, you know? I mean, our own bands and our friends' bands, and once we started putting out singles, then it was just a matter of, can we get the money together to do the next single, you know, whether it's with our own band, Superchunk or Chunk as we were called initially, or Erectus Monotone from Raleigh or Pure from Asheville.
And back then also, it seems like there were so few record labels that all you had to do was ask someone, even if you didn't really know them. Hey, can we put out a 7-inch of your music? And they'd go, oh, yeah, sure.
Yeah, is that what you guys set out to do 20 years ago, sort of be curators of this independent music streak?
No. I think, well, when we started, it felt more like what we were doing was documenting where we lived at that time musically. Because back then it seemed like all these great bands would be around for a few months and then they'd just break up and there would be no proof that they ever existed.
We're going to play a little bit of music from a merge band here. It's called Neutral Milk Hotel. So we're going to run this and then I'm going to come back with a question. So, first of all, is that a theremin in the background, do you guys think, or what?
That's a saw.
Is it really? That's it so is, funny. I asked my producer that question, and she said, no, I think it's a saw. And I was like, oh, get out of here.
Your producer knows what she's talking
about. She knows
about
a singing saw when she hears one.
You know, she picks the music for the show, and she gets lots of props for that. But how do you know when you listen to a demo that that's something you want to sign? Because that one, I mean, it took a while to get going. It was a little offbeat. I mean, Mac, how do you know?
I mean, it's interesting because that was Neutral Milk Hotel, as you said, and that song, I think, is one of their most beautiful songs. But the first thing that we got from Neutral Milk Hotel was this cassette, and it was the whole first album by Neutral Milk Hotel called On Avery Island. And it's very dense. You know, not only is there saw, but there's trombones, there's distorted acoustic guitars. It's really special. It's very unique. I mean, I think that what we look for and what we listen for and what always strikes us is really good songs, but also some sort of personality that when you hear it, it strikes you as something singular.
Mac, when you guys really sat down and got serious about this, did you actually have a business model or did you say, well, you know, we'll split it 50-50 and, you know, plow our money back into our production and those kinds of things?
We still haven't had that sit down where we get serious about it. But, right, why start now? No, but even when we were, you know, as small as we could possibly be, we had models to look at in terms of other labels that existed at the time. Discord in Washington, D.C., Teen Beat in Washington, D.C., Sub Pop, of course. We had labels that we could look at and see, like, well, you know, how do they do it? What distributors do they use? What stores do they get their records into? You know, then everyone was open to talking about it. You know, there was no trade secrets among independent labels.
Is there a song you guys can agree on that we should go out on after this?
Well, maybe we should go out on a new song from the latest Clean record, and we could hear In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul.
Oh, that's a good one.
All right. In the Dream Life, You Need a Rubber Soul. Laura Balance and Mac McConaughey, the co-founders of Merge Records, they've got a new book out with John Cook. It's called Our Noise, the story of Merge Records, the indie label that got big and stayed small. Guys, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We learned of a near ideal clinical sampling of swine flu today and how easily that disease can spread. This past July, it seems more than 100 new Air Force Academy cadets got sick with the H1N1 virus. They were quarantined. The outbreak was contained within 2 weeks, but that is the good news. The bad news is that almost a quarter of them were still contagious more than 24 hours after their symptoms disappeared. That 24-hour mark is when the CDC says it's okay to go back to work, which turns this story into a real problem for the rest of us, because half of America's private sector workers don't get paid sick leave. So it's pretty tempting to show up at the office anyway. Kurt Nickisch reports from WBUR in Boston.
Melissa Hinckley walks around with hand sanitizer in her purse, but not because she's a hypochondriac.
I'm more afraid of how much it will cost me time and money than actually being sick.
Twice a week, you'll find her here taking classes at the University of Massachusetts. The other weekdays, she works as a nanny for $9.25 an hour. Melissa doesn't get paid sick leave, so if she's out sick for one day, she's out one-third of her weekly paycheck. She says the pressure to throw back some Tylenol and fight through it is real.
So here I am, sick a couple weeks ago, and I go to work, and the mom happened to be home that day. She was like, are you okay? And I'm like, I think I have a really bad sinus infection. She's like, go home, go get better. And I'm sitting there thinking, I don't want to go. I literally can't afford to be sick.
But businesses can't afford sick workers showing up. Here at the Boston dry cleaning chain, Dependable Cleaners, workers are laundering and pressing shirts whose sleeves people have sneezed into and wiped their noses on. Owner Krista Haggerty is afraid if just one of her workers comes down with swine flu and comes into one of her 14 stores, it could wipe out the rest of the staff there.
You know, most people wait until they can't lift their head off the pillow. Here, this swine flu, it's much more contagious, and it's contagious longer than past flus, the ones that we're used to.
So this flu season, Hagerty's offering all 220 of her employees 3 paid sick days. It wasn't an easy decision. The recession has been hard on her business, and this could cost her 660 paid days in all.
So in a sense, it's as if we were adding a couple additional full-time employees for a whole year. That would be the cost, without getting the employees. In fact, we'll probably incur other costs covering the employees' route.
Those costs are why Hagerty's the exception. A recent Harvard study concluded that half of the nation's businesses aren't doing anything to prepare for swine flu. And most of those that are doing more of the usual stuff. David Casey runs a Boston steakhouse called The Stockyard. He's been installing more hand sanitizer and telling workers to sneeze into their elbows.
I don't think you want your waitress coming up with a runny nose or with a cough.
His workers don't get paid sick leave. It's up to them to keep themselves healthy, Casey says, or else he'll send them home.
It's a judgment call. You know, we don't want to shoot ourselves in the foot. You know, we don't want a complaint letters constantly. It will be a tough call, a judgment call.
That cough you just heard? Yeah. Casey says he's coming down with a little bit of a cold. In Boston, I'm Kurt Nickisch for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by SunGard. 1,600 universities and colleges teach and manage 10 million students with software from SunGard Higher Education. More information at sunguard.com. And by Putnam Investments, seeking new ways to reduce the effects of market volatility for investors. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today, it's got graphs and charts in it, so it's a tricky one to do on the radio, but I figure I'll give it a shot. The Pew Center's Project for Excellence in Journalism came out with a new study the other day called Covering the Great Recession. The chart that really hit me when I saw it this morning plotted the Dow Industrials against the amount of news coverage the economy was getting. And I figure you know where this one's going. The worse the Dow does, the more coverage the economy gets. So back in March, with the Dow down at 6,500 plus or minus, the economy took up 55% of the available news space. Today, with the blue chips better than 10,000, economic coverage down near the single digits. But hey, we do appreciate you listening. You can check out the chart I'm talking about on our website. It's marketplace.org. That is Marketplace from American Public Media this Tuesday afternoon. Today, the Dow rolled down 50 points, 0.5%. The Nasdaq shaved off 12 points, also 0.5%. The S&P 500 gave back 6 points, 0.2%. Vahan Baladuni, Ravi Karman, Stephen Colon, Andrea Jackson, Gewurz, Eric Johnson, Jeff Peters, and Charlton Thorpe engineered the program for us. Coming up next time, can chocolate possibly be considered cool?
I would imagine a couple of years ago, my perception of Cadbury might have been slightly old and fusty, very traditional product.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.